Welcome to Hanchuck Targets History. I'm your host, Tim Hanchuck. Thanks for joining me this episode. You know, I've been teaching high school history for way too many years, and I love talking about this stuff. So let me share with you some interesting, unique, and little-known historical events. I know you'll be entertained, and if you're not careful, you just might learn something too. So, let's lock and load and take a shot at that target of history and see what we can hit. Let's take a walk down range and see what the target shows us. Well, looks like today we'll be talking about a different kind of revolution, the Industrial Revolution. So no battles or fighting, instead we're talking about building. Let's see how this came about. The Industrial Revolution began in Great Britain. Okay, when? I don't know. It's not something whose beginning can be pinpointed by a specific year. But for the sake of argument, let's say it began, around 1760. All right, so why did it start in Britain? Well, it's not like they planned it. It just sort of happened. But the reason it happened was because all the factors needed for a country to industrialize came together at that time and at that place. Let's see what those factors were. First off, an agricultural revolution in the 1700s applied new scientific methods to farming. The results were that more food could be grown more efficiently. Years of bountiful harvests lowered food prices. This allowed the typical family to not have to spend as much on food, freeing up income for other things, thus creating an increased demand for manufactured goods. On top of this, a larger food supply allowed for a potentially larger population that would also increase demand for manufactured goods. Furthermore, as efficiency increased, it actually lessened the number of agricultural workers needed. Britain had long had a large class of hired agricultural workers, or we could say rural proletarians. These rural wage earners were relatively mobile, and they formed a potential industrial labor force to work the factories. Next, Britain also had a growing market for their goods. I mean, why ramp up production if nobody wants to buy your stuff? I already mentioned the growing population with more available income to spend. So that's your domestic market. On top of that, let's not forget Britain's large colonial empire, upon which the sun never set. It provided a large supply of raw materials and created a huge demand for manufactured goods. Third, Britain had an abundance of natural resources like coal and iron ore, which were relatively easy to access. There was also the means to transport these resources cheaply and efficiently by water. It's said that at this time, no part of Britain was more than 20 miles from navigable water. And beginning in the 1770s, a canal building boom enhanced this transportation advantage even more. Furthermore, there were no internal tariffs to hinder trade, like there were in France, at least before their revolution, or in the fragmented German states. Fourth, Britain had amazing political stability at this time. The monarchy and the aristocratic oligarchy that had jointly ruled the country since the Glorious Revolution in 1688 provided that stability. Here was a government that let the domestic economy operate with few controls and that encouraged personal initiative, technical change, and the free market system. This in turn encouraged entrepreneurs who had the financial capital to invest, to take a chance on new industries without having to worry about the country's government changing overnight or even developing into a state of revolution. So yeah, as I said, all these factors came together in Britain to create a veritable perfect storm, if you will, to initiate the Industrial Revolution. Now the term Industrial Revolution wasn't used until the 1830s. When it began to be thrown around to describe the explosion of major inventions and technological developments that had taken place from the later 1700s onward. These inventions and technological developments went hand in hand with the impressive quickening in the annual rate of industrial growth in Britain. Here's some stats. Before the Industrial Revolution, say from 1700 to 1760, the annual industrial growth rate was about 0.7%. Certainly nothing to write home about. But between 1801 and 1831, when the Industrial Revolution was really cranked up, the annual industrial growth rate more than tripled to about 3%. Now that is impressive. And we could say that the decisive quickening of growth most likely came in the 1780s, after the American War of Independence and before Britain got involved in fighting France during their revolution and then the Napoleonic Wars. For Britain, the Industrial Revolution began in the textile industry. Up to this point, textile production had been a thriving cottage industry. A rural family would own a spinning wheel or two and a weaving loom. In their own cottage, the wife, and most likely the children as well, would spin thread, which the husband would weave into cloth on the loom, which the family would then sell. This putting out system worked well and created a family enterprise in which there was work for all. The problem with this system, though, was that there always seemed to be an imbalance in production. The work of four or five spinners was needed to keep up with one weaver. As a result, a family might have to hire widows or unmarried women to spin thread for them to make up for their shortage. And this, by the way, is where we get the term spinster for an older, unmarried woman. If this wasn't feasible, perhaps one of the family's older children would set off to nearby villages looking for a supply of thread there to buy. By 1760, a rising demand for cloth, coupled with the seemingly constant shortage of thread, led to the beginning of changes being made in how textiles were produced. The solution, of course, was to create a better spinning wheel. The problem with this, though, was try as they might, it proved to be extremely difficult to spin the traditional raw materials, wool and flax, with improved machines. The solution to this dilemma was cotton. The East India Company was the first to import cotton textiles into Britain from India. And by 1760, there was a small but potentially expanding domestic cotton industry in the northern part of England. And cotton could easily be spun on improved machines. To that end, a rather talented carpenter named James Hargreaves invented what is known as the spinning jenny. It was a simple and inexpensive machine that could be used in the home. It was a frame that mounted anywhere from 6 to 24 spindles on a sliding carriage, with each spindle spinning a fine, slender thread. The spinner would move the carriage back and forth with one hand while turning a hand crank to supply power with the other. Now, popular legend says Hargreaves named this machine the spinning jenny after his daughter. Unfortunately, this isn't true. A search of church records from his hometown show that while he did have some daughters, none of them were named Jenny. And no, neither was his wife. It seems that actually Jenny was probably a slang abbreviation on the word engine. Also at around the same time, a former barber named Richard Arkwright invented another kind of spinning machine known as the water frame. Although some people have made the claim that maybe he borrowed this design from someone else, either way, it was a much larger machine holding several hundred spindles. Thus, it needed much more power to operate, and that would come from water. The water frame thus needed large, specialized mills built along rivers. These were some of the first factories, and even in the beginning, they might employ upwards of 1,000 workers. Now, the thing with the water frame was that it could only spin coarse thread. This would still have to be sent out to the cottages to be respun on the jennies into something finer. With these two inventions, the cotton textile industry really took off in the 1780s, when it was increasing the value of its output at the crazy rate of 13% a year. By 1790, these new machines were producing 10 times as much cotton thread as had been made 20 years earlier. Also in 1790, Samuel Crompton invented a new machine known as the spinning mule. And no, there's no legend about it being named after any of his family members. This machine was also large and water-powered, and did an even better and faster job spinning fine thread than the spinning jenny. As use of the mule became more widespread, all cotton spinning left the houses completely for the factories. By the way, old Sammy never patented his machine, so he never saw any royalties from the almost 5 million mules that were in operation by the early 1800s. But don't feel too bad for him. He toured factories throughout Britain, counting how many of his machines were in use, and presented his findings to Parliament. In 1812, they awarded him £5,000. Today, that would be like £373,000 in change, or almost half a million U.S. dollars. The first consequences of these early revolutionary developments were actually more beneficial than what is generally believed. Cotton goods became cheaper and could be purchased by all classes. In the past, only the wealthy could afford the comfort and cleanliness of underwear. This was called body linen because it was made from expensive linen cloth. Now, millions of other people who had been going commando up to this point could afford not only cotton underwear, but also a variety of cheap but sturdy cotton shirts, vests, coats, dresses. With the supply of thread no longer an issue, it now became the weavers working at their home looms who were hard-pressed to keep up with rising demand. Because of this, the wages of weavers rose rapidly until around 1792, when they were some of the highest-paid laborers in all of Britain. Because of this, many agricultural workers ditched their farms and became hand loom weavers. This was all good for the weavers, but not so good for the capitalists and their bottom line. If only weaving could be mechanized like spinning, there'd be a huge savings in labor costs. In 1785, this dilemma was solved, or maybe I should say began to be solved, when Edmund Cartwright patented the power loom. I say began to be solved because this device was extremely poor. Cartwright came out with a better machine in 1789, but even that had many shortcomings, although it did serve as a model for later inventors to refine. As a result, it wouldn't be until the early years of the 1800s that power looms were fast and efficient enough to fully replace hand weavers. Production soared. Check out this stat. By 1831, the cotton textile industry accounted for 22% of Britain's entire industrial production. So we have these early textile factories, and let's say that the working conditions in them were less than satisfactory, especially to people who had been used to working out of their own homes. Because factory owners had a difficult time attracting adult workers, they often turned to using young children. Local parishes, who had numerous orphaned and abandoned kids in their care, would apprentice these children to the factories. The parish thus saved money because it didn't have to take care of the kids anymore, and the factory owner got a bunch of cheap labor. Children as young as 5 or 6 would be apprenticed and were forced by law to work for their master, the factory, for as many as 14 years. They were housed in factory dormitories, which were locked up nightly, lest any kids escape. They were fed, although the quality and quantity of the food was rather limited. And they worked six days a week for as long as 14 hours a day. Harsh physical punishments, including whippings, maintained brutal discipline. Ouch, not a very happy childhood at all. And with no education, not much hope for a better lot in life once their apprenticeship ended. They'd probably continue being factory workers. Of course, the wholesale exploitation of these parish apprentices ultimately drew outrage from social reformers. But this didn't happen until we get into the early to mid-1800s and later. Now, the growth of the cotton textile industry might have been stunted or cut short had water remained the primary source of power for the factories. Having to locate factories near flowing water caused some issues. The location might be away from large pools of workers or from the markets of the produced goods. Furthermore, drought or even just a lessening of the river's flow could slow down or shut down a factory. No, for the textile industry to continue to expand and for other industries to be able to follow suit, the age-old problem of energy and power had to be solved. For much of Britain's history, its chief source of energy was wood. But by the 1700s, wood was in short supply. As this energy crisis grew worse, Britain began to look to its abundant supply of coal as an alternative energy source. Coal had first been used in the late Middle Ages as a source of heat. By 1640, most homes in London were heated by coal, and it was also used as a heat source for making things like beer, glass, and soap. But it had yet to be used to produce mechanical energy or to power machinery. That was about to change. As more coal was being produced, mines were dug deeper and deeper and were constantly filling with water. Mechanical pumps were used to get rid of the water. These were powered by horses hitched to crossbeams walking in a circle to operate the pump. A mine might employ hundreds of horses to work these pumps. This was expensive and quite bothersome. So how to overcome those disadvantages? Enter the steam engine. In 1698, Thomas Savery, and in 1705, Thomas Newcomen, both invented the first primitive steam engines. Both were highly inefficient and burned a ridiculous amount of coal to operate, but they were better than horses. And what did it matter how much coal they used? They were being operated at coal mines, so the fuel was right there. And by the 1770s, many Savery engines and hundreds of Newcomen engines were in operation. Of course, with the engine's inefficiency and huge appetite for coal, the mines were the only place they could be operated and be cost effective. But that too was about to change. In the 1760s, a highly talented young Scot named James Watt was employed by the University of Glasgow. At this time, various Scottish universities were pioneers in practical technical education, and his job was to make scientific instruments for the school. In 1765, Watt was called on to repair a Newcomen steam engine that the school was using in a physics class. While he repaired the machine, he also studied it and saw how inefficient it was. He realized that adding a separate condenser to the engine could reduce the waste of energy that was happening. He began to tinker with this improvement and in 1769 patented his invention. This made steam engines way more efficient and opened up its potential uses. By the late 1780s, the steam engine had become a practical and commercial success. It is no doubt that the steam engine of Watt, and those who refined it afterwards, was the Industrial Revolution's most fundamental advance in technology. For the very first time in history, humanity had, at least for a few generations, almost unlimited power at its disposal. For the first time, inventors and engineers could design and implement all kinds of power equipment to aid people in their work. For the first time, abundance was at least a possibility for ordinary men and women. The steam engine, this new modern marvel, was quickly put to work. It continued to be used in coal mines, allowing the production of even more coal that could be used to feed even more steam engines. By the 1780s, it began to replace water power in the textile mills, leading to their meteoric rise in production. And from there, it spread like a wildfire to a host of other industries. Steam power promoted important breakthroughs in other industries as well. let's take a look at the British iron industry and how it was radically transformed by steam. After 1770, the use of powerful, steam-driven bellows in blast furnaces helped iron makers switch from limited charcoal to unlimited coke, which is made from coal, in the smelting of pig iron. In the 1780s, Henry Cort developed the puddling furnace, which allowed pig iron to be refined with coke. Cort also developed heavy-duty steam-powered rolling mills, capable of producing finished iron in a variety of shapes and forms. The economic consequences of these technical innovations were a great boom to the British iron industry. Check out these statistics. In 1740, annual British iron production was 17,000 tons. That's not much. With the spread of coke smelting and Cort's inventions, production hit 68,000 tons in 1788. In 1806, it was up to 260,000 tons. In 1844, Britain produced 3 million tons of iron. That's a staggering expansion in the space of about 100 years. Iron, which was once scarce and expensive, now became the cheap, basic, indispensable building block of the economy. Now, of course, the steam engine also had a fundamental impact on plenty of other things during the Industrial Revolution, especially transportation. Railroads and steamships would transform society like never before. But talking about them, well, that would be another story. And there you have it, kind listeners. Thank you for tuning in. Now, if you like this episode, please tell your friends about it and check out some of my other episodes. I very much look forward to talking with you again next week.